She wanted to go to university, but Pa says it was a waste of time educating women. I think she had someone she wanted to marry, but he went into the RAF and he was shot down and he's in a prison camp in Germany. So it's all rather sad, isn't it? This horrid war spoiling everybody's lives. Alfie nodded. My dad's with the army in North Africa, he said. We hardly ever hear from him, and when we do, it's a tiny little bit of paper with most of the words blacked out by the censor. Mum cried the last time one came. Alfie was getting out of breath, walking fast to keep up with the pony and talking at the same time as they crossed the soft grass of the parkland, went through a stand of trees and came out to the edge of the formal gardens. There were still perfect rows of rose bushes and herbaceous borders, but the flower beds were now overgrown and the roses hadn't been pruned. To one side, the lawn had been dug up and turned into another kitchen garden. And beyond them, where the forecourt had once allowed carriages to draw up, there were rows of camouflaged army vehicles. Alfie hardly ever came this close to the big house. He stared at it now in wonder. He'd been taken to Buckingham Palace once, but this was just as big and imposing. It was built of solid grey stone, was 3 stories high, and the roof was adorned with towers at both ends. 2 wings came out from the front to create the shape of an E, with the imposing central entry making the middle bar of the letter. The pillars at this central entrance supported a pediment adorned with classical figures engaged in a battle. The impression of grandeur was marred, however, by a group of soldiers sauntering down the marble steps, laughing and smoking. More soldiers were standing around army vehicles of various shapes and sizes, and from the other side of the house sounded the tramp of boots and shouts of drill sergeants as the ranks were put through morning parade. 2 officers approached, walking toward a jeep.
"Hello, young lady. Going out for a ride, are you?" one of them said affably.
"I've already been, thank you," Phoebe said primly. "We're just taking my pony back to the stables." She looked down at Alfie as soon as they were past the soldiers. "Don't mention to my father that I was out riding alone. He'd be furious. I'm not supposed to go out without the groom. But that's so silly, isn't it? I'm a perfectly good rider, and the groom is getting old and doesn't like to gallop."
Alfie nodded. Now that he was close to the big house, his stomach had tied itself in knots. He remembered too clearly the day he had arrived here. When he had first come by train from the smoke, as he called it, he had been a pathetic-looking little specimen, scrawny and small for his age, wearing short trousers 1 size too big, revealing skinny knees covered in scabs. His nose was running, and he wiped it with the back of his hand, leaving a trail of snot across his cheek. No wonder he had been the last of the evacuated children to find someone willing to take him in. In the end, the billeting officer, Miss Hemphatchet, local justice of the peace and girl guide captain, had put him in the back of her Morris and driven him to Farley.
"You'll have to have him, Lady Westrum," she had said in the voice that made generations of girl guides snap to attention. "There is simply nobody else, and you do have a bigger place than the rest of us."
Then she had departed, leaving the boy standing there, staring in awe at the marble foyer with its weapons and portraits of ancestors glaring down at him with looks of distaste.
"Damn blasted cheek!" Lord Westerham exploded when Lady Westerham came to report this to him. "Who does the bloody woman think she is bossing us around? Where do these damned people think we're going to put the brat? We've already had 2/3 of our house taken from us by the army. We're reduced to 1 bally wing, and a damned inconvenient wing it is too. Does she think I'm going to put a child from the London slums on a camp bed in my bedroom? Or should he bunk in with one of our daughters?"
"Don't shout, Roddy,"
Lady Westerham said in her calm way, after 30 years, accustomed to her husband's outbursts.
It makes your eyes bulge most unpleasantly. There is a war on. We have to do our bit, and it must seem to most people that we have more than our fair share.
So we're supposed to have a slum child given free rein of our house? Running around pinching silver, I shouldn't wonder. It's not on, Esme. It's simply not on. How am I supposed to enjoy a gin and tonic in my study, never knowing whether I'm going to be interrupted by a Cockney child? Tell that hemp what's-it woman that we won't do it, and that's that.
The poor little mite has to find somewhere to stay, Roddy, Lady Westerham said gently. We can't send him back to bombed streets. His parents might even be dead. How would you feel if you were wrenched from all you knew?
What about the tenant farmers?
They've already taken in children.
Then the outdoor staff? Aren't there any spare cottages?
You can't put a child in an empty cottage. She paused, a pensive look coming over her face. I've got it. The Robinses might have a spare bedroom since their son was called up. Robins isn't the friendliest of individuals, I'll give you that, but Mrs. R is a good cook. The poor little mite needs fattening up.
Alfie had been overhearing this conversation as he stood alone and shivering in the foyer. They hadn't realized that his biggest fear was that he'd have to stay in a place like this, where he'd be terrified every moment of meeting a ghost or breaking something. A cottage with a good cook in it sounded like a much better idea.
"Here, hold the bridle a moment while I dismount," Phoebe said, jerking him back into the present.
Alfie realized she was used to giving orders. He did as he was told, even though he'd never touched a horse before. The pony stood, still and placid, while Phoebe kicked her feet from the stirrups and swung herself down. Then she set out for the stables, leaving Alfie to walk behind her, still leading the pony. They had just rounded the corner when a groom came running toward them, red-faced and waving his arms.
"You shouldn't have taken Snowball out alone without me, your ladyship. You know what his lordship said."
"Rubbish, Jackson. You know I ride perfectly well."
Phoebe tossed her head defiantly, and it seemed that the pony mirrored her action, almost jerking the reins from Alfie's grasp.
"I know you're a splendid little rider, my lady," he said. I think your dad is more concerned about all them soldiers hanging around here. Not safe any more, even on our own grounds.
Phoebe's cheeks were rather pink, but she said,
You can take Snowball now. I have to tell my father something important.
The groom took the pony, and Alfie followed Phoebe, who was already striding out for the big house. He had to run to catch up with her as she headed up the front steps. For a moment, he was tempted to let her go in alone. He could sneak back to the gamekeeper's cottage where he knew breakfast would be waiting. But at the last second, she turned back, holding open the door.
"Come along, Alfie. Do get a move on," she said impatiently.
The entrance hall was as daunting as he remembered it. Now their feet were echoing on the marble-tiled floor to the painted vault of ceiling high above. A group of officers was coming down the main staircase.
"We could tell them,"
Alfie whispered to Phoebe.
"I told you, it's my father's land. He has to know first," Phoebe said.
She passed the officers, who nodded to her as they crossed the foyer, then she turned left. The long gallery that ran the length of the building had been boarded up with plywood, with a newly erected door in it marked Family Quarters, Private. Phoebe opened the door, and Alfie found himself in the gallery. It was lined with oak panelling, the high ceiling was carved with gilded Tudor roses, and along its length were trophy heads of animals as well as tapestries of hunting scenes. To Alfie, it was quite alarming, but Phoebe strode on, not seeming to notice. At the end of the hall, they came to another foyer with a staircase on one side, not as grand as the central one. Phoebe looked around.
"I do hope he's up. I'm sure he must be up."
At the sound of her voice, a butler appeared.
"You've been out riding already, my lady.
A fine morning."
"Have you seen my father, Soames?"
Phoebe cut into his words.
"I must find him. It's important."
"I saw him come down the stairs a few minutes ago, my lady, but I'm not sure where he went. Would you like me to locate him for you?"
"It's all right. We'll find him. Come on, Alfie,"
Phoebe said as she set off again down a central hallway lined with family portraits.
"Pa,"
she called.
"Pa, where are you?"
Lord Westerham was sitting at the breakfast table, about to attack a mound of kedgeree.
"Thank God for kippers," he was thinking, "one of the few things that are still worth eating."
Not that they appeared often at the local fishmongers, since fishing in the North Sea had become such a dangerous occupation. But when the odd kipper was available, the fishmonger always sent a message to Farley and reserved a couple behind the counter.
"I know how fond his lordship is of his kippers,"
the fishmonger's wife said. In the good old days, it would have been a pair of kippers each for breakfast. Now Mrs. Mortlock had to make the most of them by using them in a kedgeree instead of the traditional smoked haddock. He had just taken a mouthful when he heard someone shouting. He had barely identified the voice as his youngest daughter as she burst into the room.
"Was that you making that unseemly row?"
Lord Westerham scowled at her, waving his fork.
"Does your governess not teach you the rudiments of good behaviour?"
"No, Pa. She's always telling me that a lady never raises her voice, but it's an emergency. I simply had to find you right away. We found a body. At least Alfie found it, and he stopped me from riding over it."
"What? What's this?"
Lord Westerham put down his fork and glared at Alfie, trying to remember who he was and why a strange child was in his breakfast room.
"A body, Father, in the far field. He fell out of the sky. It's rather horrible, but you have to come."
"His parachute didn't open,"
Alfie added, then rather wished he had stayed silent as Lord Westerham turned to glare at him. Lord Westerham's glare, under those bushy eyebrows, was quite alarming, and Alfie swallowed nervously, glancing at the door and wondering if a bolt was possible.
"What were you doing on my land? Poaching, I shouldn't wonder,"
Lord Westerham said.
"No, sir. I'm staying with your gamekeeper, remember?"
Alfie said.
"Oh, yes, so you are."
"And he sends me out to check the traps in the early morning," Alfie said. "And I saw this thing lying there, and I didn't know what it was, so I went to look, and it was this bloke all smashed up, a right mess. And then your daughter came galloping toward him, so I stopped her, and she said we should tell you first."
"Quite right, quite right."
Lord Westerham put down his napkin and stood up.
"Well, I suppose you'd better take me to sea, hadn't you?"
He glared in annoyance as two English setters raced toward the door, sensing that their master was about to go out.
"And make sure those blasted dogs don't get out. I don't want them nosing about a corpse."
He looked down at them, their feathery tails wagging excitedly. Eyes fixed on him, and his tone softened in a way that he never addressed his children.
"Sorry, St. John. Sorry, Missy, old girl. Can't take you this time, but we'll make up for it later."
He gave them a quick pat on the head.
"Now stay," he commanded.
Both dogs sat, looking worried. As their little party reached the end of the long gallery, Phoebe turned to see the dog still sitting in a shaft of sunlight.
Chapter 3 Farley, The Kitchen, May 1941
What was that kerfuffle all about, Mr. Soames?
Mrs. Mortlock looked up from the kitchen table, her arms elbow deep in flour as the butler was coming through the baize door.
Young Elsie said she heard shouting when she was carrying up the hot water for Miss Livy.
Lady Phoebe seemed most agitated about something, Mr. Soames said in his calm and measured way. I didn't quite hear the full story, but I caught something about a body.
A body? Well, I never. What next?
Mrs. Mortlock brushed off her hands so that a cloud of flour rose around her.
Poor Lady Phoebe. Don't tell me she came upon a body. A shock like that could unhinge the mind of a delicate young girl like Lady Phoebe.
Mr. Soames smiled.
I rather suspect that Lady Phoebe is as tough as any of us, Mrs. Mortlock, but as you say, it is most worrying to think of a body here at Farley.
Where was it found, Mr. Soames? Anyone we know?
Mrs. Mortlock asked, moving away from her mixing bowl now that she was truly interested.
Not that I heard, just that she had found a body, and since she had just come in wearing her riding outfit, one must assume she found it on the grounds.
It's them soldiers,
Ruby the kitchen maid commented from the kitchen sink.
They're all sex-starved.
There was a gasp from Mrs. Mortlock.
Ruby, where did you hear such language?
Mr. Soames demanded.
It's not what I expect from the servants in a house like this.
I heard it from Elsie, Ruby said. She was telling Jenny, and she gets it from the picture papers. They're always talking about sex in Hollywood. Anyway, Elsie said them soldiers are all sex-starved. Some of them invited her to go to the pub with them when she was polishing the door knocker.
I hope she put them in their place, Mrs. Mortlock said.
Speak to her, Mr. Soames.
We can't let down standards just because there's a war on. I most certainly will speak to her, Mrs. Mortlock. That's what happens when there's no housekeeper and no senior servants to supervise things. The young ones get ideas.
Did they say what kind of body it was?
Mrs. Mortlock asked.
I bet they lured some girl from the village here and had their way with her, and she died of shock,
Ruby went on.
That's enough, Ruby, Mr. Soames said firmly. I don't wish to hear such talk again.
And luckily, Ruby will be so fully occupied with washing up and peeling potatoes that she is not likely to encounter any of the soldiers,
Mrs. Mortlock said, giving Ruby a long warning look.
And if she doesn't get a move on, we'll be behind with the luncheon.
I don't know what his lordship will say when he finds out it's vegetable pie again, but we've no more meat coupons for the rest of the month.
It don't seem fair that the family can't eat their own meat when they've got a farm and all them animals.
Those animals, Ruby. Really, your grammar leaves a lot to be desired,
Mr. Soames sighed.
I'm not really complaining, Mrs. Mortlock said. I know we do better than most, and it's only right that those that raise food share it with those who live in the cities. But it's certainly a challenge trying to come up with appetizing meals on the ration of a quarter pound of meat per person per week.
And it don't seem fair that I'm stuck in a kitchen washing up when I could be making good money in a factory,
Ruby muttered, half to herself.
And what factory would take you?
Mrs. Mortlock demanded.
You have to be sharp and nimble to work in a factory. You're all thumbs. You wouldn't last a day. No, my girl, you thank your lucky stars her ladyship took you on here. Otherwise it would have been a land girl digging potatoes out in the freezing rain.
I wouldn't mind. At least there would be people to talk to, Ruby said. It's no fun now all the footmen have gone,
and we're down to Elsie and Jenny and her ladyship's maid and nanny.
It's not exactly fun for us either, Ruby,
Mr. Soames said.
I am not thrilled about waiting at table and doing footman's work at my age and with my seniority, but I do it cheerfully, knowing that the family depends on me. Above all, we do not let the family down. We try to make it seem that this place is running as it always had. Is that clear?
Yes, Mr. Soames, Ruby said in a dutiful voice. Don't you think we should send up some hot chocolate with brandy in it to Lady Phoebe? Mrs. Mortlock asked. They say brandy is the thing for shock, don't they?
Knowing young people, I suspect that Lady Phoebe is more thrilled than shocked at finding a body, Mrs. Mortlock, and will now be tucking in to a large and satisfying breakfast.
Mr. Soames smiled as he walked toward the door. Phoebe was just coming out of her bedroom when a door farther down the hall opened and a bleary-eyed head poked out.
"Was that you running up and down the hall and waking everyone at the crack of dawn?"
Lady Diana Sutton asked in a petulant voice. She was wearing blue silk pyjamas and her blonde bob was tousled.
"Dawn cracked hours ago, Dido," Phoebe said. "I've already been out riding, and you'll never guess what I found."
"I can hardly wait. The suspense is killing me."
Lady Diana came out into the hall and leaned against the doorframe in what she hoped was a blasé and sophisticated manner.
"Could it have been mushrooms? Or a fox, maybe?"
"It was a body, Dido," Phoebe said.
"A body? Of a person? Dead?"
"Bodies usually are, and this one was very dead indeed. It had fallen from an aeroplane."
"How do you know that?"
"Because he was wearing the remains of a parachute that didn't open properly."
"Golly!"
Dido suddenly forgot her sophistication.
"Have you told Pa?"
"Yes, and he's gone to talk to the army people."
"Hold on a minute," Lady Diana said. "I'll get some clothes on, and you can show me before they move it away."
"I don't think Pa would like that," Phoebe said. "Not when he's with the army people."
"Don't be such a wet blanket, Phoebes," Diana said. "You know I have to make the most of the only excitement we're likely to get around here. I don't know about you, but I'm dying of boredom."
"It's just not fair. I should have had my season and come out by now. I might even have been engaged to a yummy French count like Margot is. Instead, there are only boring soldiers and aged farmers, and Pa won't even let me go up to London. He won't even let me be a land girl because he says the farmhands only have one thing on their minds."
"Doesn't he know that I'm positively drooling for that one thing?"
"What thing is that?" Phoebe asked. "A boyfriend?"
"Sex, darling. You don't understand, but you will one day."
She gave Phoebe a withering look.
"I hate this stupid war, and I'm going to take a look at that body, whether you show me or not."
She turned and went back into her bedroom, slamming the door so that the pictures on the wall shook dangerously on their hooks. Chapter 4 A Field at Farley, May 1941.
"Well?"
Lord Westerham looked up at the officer standing beside him.
"One of yours, is he?"
He was not at all pleased with having the Royal West Kents taking over his house, but he tolerated Colonel Pritchard, their commanding officer, reasonably well. He was a gentleman, one of the right sort, and he had gone to some trouble to make sure the army caused the least disruption possible. Colonel Pritchard looked rather green about the gills as he stared down at the corpse. He was a small, dapper man with a neat little moustache. Out of uniform, he would not have been taken for a soldier, a city gent, maybe, or a bank manager.
He now moved his shoe out of the area of blood-soaked grass.
"Our chaps don't go leaping out of aeroplanes," he said. "We're strictly infantry."
"But isn't he wearing your uniform?"
"Hard to tell. Looks a little like it," the colonel frowned. "But as I say, if any man under my command had been given permission to jump out of a plane, I should have been told. Besides, I also should have heard if they were not all present and accounted for."
"So what's the procedure now?" Lord Westerham demanded. "We can't have him lying here in my field, scaring my deer. Someone's going to have to remove him. Should we summon the local police and have him taken to the nearest morgue?"
"I hardly think that's appropriate," Colonel Pritchard said. "The chap is in uniform, after all. It will be an army matter. Someone will know who he is, or was, rather. Someone will have ordered a bungled parachute jump last night, although why here, I can't tell you."
"Perhaps he drifted off course in the wind."
"Hardly any breeze last night," Colonel Pritchard said. "Besides, judging by the shape that parachute is in, he didn't do much drifting. I suppose we could take a look at the poor blighter's identity discs. Then at least we'll know who he was and where he came from."
He gave a shudder of surprised distaste at this thought. Between them, they bent to turn over the body. It felt like moving a bag of odd bits and pieces, as if every bone had been smashed, and even Lord Westerham shuddered this time. The front of the corpse was a bloody mess, his face unrecognizable. The colonel turned away as he opened the top button on the uniform and hauled out the identity tags. It was hard to tell that one had been red and one green, and the cord that held them was now sticky and crusting. Flies had already located the body and were arriving in droves, their buzzing filling the quiet of the meadow. Colonel Pritchard removed a knife from his pocket and cut the cord that held the discs.
"Can't read anything at the moment. They'll have to wash away the blood."
He took a starched white handkerchief from his pocket and carefully placed the tags inside it.
"There you are. He was one of yours,"
Lord Westrum said, pointing down at the flash on his shoulder. Through the blood and grime they could just make out the words, "Royal West Kents."
"Good God," Colonel Pritchard stared. "What did he think he was doing? Out for a joyride or some kind of prank? Had a pal in the RAF and was going to surprise us all by dropping in on morning roll call? Let's hope his fate dissuades anyone else from such foolishness."
Diana hurried down the steps and out onto the grounds. She was well aware of the surreptitious looks she was getting from the soldiers she passed, and allowed herself a secret smile. She was wearing red linen trousers and a white halter top, a little too cold for the time of day, but highly fashionable. On her feet were rope-soled wedge sandals. By the time she had crossed the first lawns, the sandals were wet with dew, and she rather regretted that she had not put on a cardigan. But such thoughts vanished as she approached the group of soldiers in the process of lifting the body onto a stretcher. It was already covered with a sheet. An ambulance stood nearby. The men looked up as Diana came toward them, and she saw the astonishment and appreciation in their faces.
"You don't want to come anywhere near here, miss,"
one of them said, coming over to intercept her.
"There's been a nasty accident, I'm afraid." "She's not miss. That's his lordship's daughter," an older man, wearing sergeant's stripes, corrected him. "You have to say, my lady."
"Sorry, I'm sure, my lady," the young man said. "Don't worry about it. I really don't care about all these silly rules. My name's Diana, and I came out to see the body."
"You wouldn't want to see it, Lady Diana, trust me," the older man said. "What a mess. Poor bloke."
"Was he a spy, do you think?"
Diana asked. You hear about German spies parachuting in, don't you? This made them chuckle.
If he was, he'd got hold of our army uniform, the older one said. No, it's my guess he was on some kind of training mission that went wrong, poor bugger.
Then he remembered to whom he was speaking and grimaced.
Pardon my language, your ladyship. They were probably trying out some new parachute prototype on him, another soldier agreed. There's a lot they don't tell us, and they use us as guinea pigs.
His friends nodded agreement.
He was wearing a ring, bloody pufter, the young one said with disgust. Well, he was married, wasn't he?
He was bloody stupid, the young one went on.
Why was that? Diana asked.
Stupid to get married?
No, your ladyship. Stupid, because if he got his ring caught during the jump, it would have ripped his finger off.
Diana shuddered, noticing how easily they spoke of such things. But then they had already fought in France and escaped from Dunkirk. They had seen friends blown up beside them. Another failed parachute jump was nothing to them. The stretcher was loaded into the ambulance and was driven away. The men headed back to the house. Diana fell into step beside them.
How long do you think you'll be staying here, do you know?
For the duration, as far as I'm concerned, the older one said. Not me, Smitty. I want to see some action. I wouldn't mind heading out to North Africa tomorrow and taking on Rommel, the young soldier who had first spoken to her said. You've only just joined up, Tom. If you'd been with us at Dunkirk, you wouldn't feel the same way. Never more grateful in my life to get home. Those blokes in their little boats did an amazing job. I came home on someone's yacht. This posh bloke crammed about 20 of us on board, horribly overloaded. I thought we were going to capsize, but we didn't. And when he dropped us off on the beach, he turned around and went back again. That takes guts, that does.
Diana nodded.
So what do you do all day when you're here? She asked.
Training, drilling, preparing for an invasion.
Do you think the Germans will invade?
I think it's only a matter of time, one of them said. They've got a bloody great war machine, but we'll be ready for them. They won't get past us without a fight.
I think you are all so brave, Diana said, watching with amusement as they looked embarrassed.
You should come down to one of the dances in the village, my lady, the bold one said. They're good fun.
I just might do that, Diana said. She didn't add, if my father lets me.
She was rather sorry to have reached the house, and she watched the men moving off toward their quarters. Back at the house, Phoebe went into her bedroom to change clothes. Jodhpurs were not allowed in the dining room, even with the relaxed rules of wartime. Now that she was alone, she found that she felt rather sick, but put it down to the fact that she hadn't had breakfast yet.
"Been out riding, Phoebe?"
Her governess, Miss Gumble, came into the room. She was tall and thin and carried herself well. Her face was now rather gaunt, but she must have been good-looking once. In fact, she came from a good family, and she might have married well, but the Great War robbed her of the chance to find a husband. She had been hired as Phoebe's governess when Dido was sent to finishing school in Switzerland. They got along well. Phoebe was a bright little girl and a pleasure to teach, even though Miss Gumble's conscience had been nagging her to abandon her post and volunteer for war work. She had a good brain. Surely she could be useful in any number of ways. Phoebe looked up.
"Oh, hello, Gumby. I didn't hear you come in. You'll never guess what. I found a body in the far field when I was riding this morning."
"A body? Good gracious. Did you tell your father?"
"Yes, and he and the army man went to take a look at it. It was a man whose parachute didn't open, and he must have fallen out of a plane. He was awfully smashed up."
"How horrid for you," Gumby said.
Yes, it was, rather, Phoebe said. But you would have been proud of me. I didn't let anyone see I was upset. The worst thing was that I almost rode over it. Can you imagine? Luckily, the boy from London who's living with the gamekeeper ran out and stopped me. He was jolly brave, actually.
Good for him.
Gumby came around behind Phoebe to do up the buttons on her cotton dress. Since Phoebe had now declared herself too old to have a nanny, her governess had taken over such tasks. She was smart enough to realize that a girl of 12 needed some looking after, even if she claimed she didn't. The child's mother, Lady Esme, was a nice enough person, but hadn't a clue about mothering her children, essentially leaving them to fend for themselves. Miss Gumble was only surprised that they all had turned out remarkably well. She smiled at Phoebe.
If I were you, I'd go down and have a jolly good breakfast before we start work. I always find that food is the best thing if you've had a shock. Food and hot, sweet tea. They work wonders.
Phoebe undid her pigtails and started to brush her hair.
I wonder who he was, poor man.
I expect it was some kind of night-time training exercise that went wrong, Miss Gumble said. You know, commando stuff.
So many horrid things seem to be happening, don't they?
Phoebe said while she tugged at a stubborn tangle in her corn-coloured hair.
Alfie said he saw a dead baby lying in the street and a woman whose clothes had been blown off her.
Poor Alfie, Miss Gumble said. He was sent here to get away from the distressing sights of the war, and now the war has followed him.
She took the brush from Phoebe.
Give me your hair ribbon. You can't go downstairs looking like Alice in Wonderland.
Phoebe turned obediently and allowed her governess to tie back her hair.
Gumby, she said, how long do you think the war will go on?
For a long time.
I hope so,
Miss Gumble replied. Phoebe spun around, shocked.
You want the war to go on?
I do, because if it ends quickly, it will mean that the Germans have conquered.
Conquered? You mean come into England?
I'm afraid so.
Do you think that might happen?
I think it's all too possible, Phoebe. We'll do our best, of course. Mr. Churchill said that we would fight them on the beaches and in our back gardens, but I wonder how many people actually would when it came to it.
My father would, Phoebe said.
Yes, I expect he would, Miss Gumble replied. But there are plenty of people who wouldn't put up a fight. We've all grown tired of war already, and if it goes on much longer, well, we'll welcome anyone who can return life to normal.
She tied the girl's hair ribbon.
Go on, go down before your father eats all the good stuff.
Chapter 5 Farley, The Breakfast Room, May 1941 Phoebe actually liked this dining room better than the cavernous oak-panelled room where they had taken their meals before the war. This had been a former music room, painted light blue with gilded trim, and tall French windows looked out over the lake. Sunlight was streaming in. It felt warm and safe because Phoebe was still cold. She had looked in vain for scrambled eggs and just served herself a plate of kedgeree when her father came in, followed by the English setters who were jumping around him excitedly.
"I hope you've left something for me, young lady," he said, striding over to the sideboard. "Would you blasted animals go away and leave me in peace? You'll get no bacon, you know. There's a war on."
"I thought you'd had breakfast."
Phoebe took a generous mouthful of rice. It was now, unfortunately, almost cold, but the bits of kipper made it taste all right.
"I was interrupted in the middle of mine, if you remember."
Lord Westerham took the silver lid off the chafing dish.
"Ah, good. There is still plenty. I suppose nobody else is up yet."
"Dido is," She wanted me to show her the body.
That young woman is going to come to a sticky end if she's not careful.
He looked up as Lady Esme came in, holding an envelope in her hand.
Hear that, Esme? Your idiot daughter wanted to see the body of a man who fell into our field.
He took his place at the head of the table, and the dog sat expectantly beside him. Lady Esme looked only vaguely surprised.
I thought I heard something of the kind when I was having my morning tea, she said. Well, I suppose she could be curious. I suppose I was at her age. Whose body was it?
Some damned army chappie, although the colonel doesn't see how it can be one of his. Bit fishy, if you ask me.
Mummy, I found the body, Phoebe said.
Lady Westerham had now taken a piece of toast and sat beside her husband.
Did you, dear? That must have been exciting for you.
Phoebe glanced at her. Gumby was perceptive enough to know that it had shocked Phoebe, but not her mother, who was now calmly opening the envelope.
Oh, it's a letter from Clemmy Churchill, she said, showing enthusiasm for the first time. I was expecting to hear from her about the garden party at Chartwell next month.
Garden party? Lord Westerham bellowed. Doesn't Clemmy Churchill know there's a war on?
Of course she does, but Winston misses Chartwell and needs cheering up, so she arranged this little garden party for him at the home he misses so much, she said. Be quiet and let me read, Roddy.
Her eyes scanned the page.
Poor thing, she said.
I hardly think that being wife of the Prime Minister can be described as a poor thing, Lord Westerham muttered between bites of breakfast.
She says that Winston is horribly overworked, gets almost no sleep, and in consequence is always bad-tempered.
Lord Westerham snorted.
Winston has always been bad-tempered, ever since I've known him. The moment anything doesn't go the way he wants it to, he explodes. I should imagine losing a war would not be kind to anyone's temper.
Lady Esme was still reading.
You know how he loves Chartwell. I'd invite them to stay with us, but...
Esme, we're packed in like sardines as it is, Lord Westerham said. You can't invite the Prime Minister of England to bunk up in the maids' quarters.
The thought of this made him chuckle.
Don't be silly, dear, Lady Westerham said calmly, not looking up from her letter. Oh, no, she exclaimed as she read on. How disappointing.
Lord Westerham raised an eyebrow.
I told you he has to come down here anyway to attend that ceremony at Biggin Hill Aerodrome next month, honouring those brave lads who were killed in the Battle of Britain. Clemmy had wanted me to help her with the garden party at Chartwell, but Winston got word of it and has put his foot down. No parties in wartime, he says. In these times of economy, we have to set an example and not open up the house for one weekend. Isn't that just like him?
Nasty Americanism, the word weekend, Lord Westerham remarked.
Although he had known Churchill for many years, he still hadn't quite forgiven him for his American mother.
Do be quiet and stop interrupting, Roddy.
Lady Westerham frowned at him across the table.
Oh, this is a splendid idea. Listen, Roddy. She wonders if they might come here for tea on the lawn after the ceremony. It would be a lovely surprise for Winston to be with the old neighbours, she says.
The Prime Minister, here to tea. What do you plan to feed them? Dandelions? Are they going to bring their own ration cards? Lord Westerham demanded.
Don't be difficult, Roddy. You know you'd love to see the Churchills again. And we do have kitchen gardens. The strawberries should be ripe, and there would be cucumbers and cress for sandwiches. We'll manage somehow, so I'll write back and tell her it's a splendid idea, shall I?
Before Lord Westerham could answer, The door opened, and Olivia, the eldest of the Sutton sisters, came in. Although she was only 26, she was already starting to look matronly. She was wearing a navy dress with a white round collar and pin-tuck pleats at the front, which emphasized her ample bosom. And she wore her hair rolled in a coil at the back of her neck, which didn't really suit her round face.
"Charlie has a bit of a cough," she said. "I hope he's not coming down with something. Has the post arrived yet, Pa? Is there anything from Teddy?"
"Nothing but a couple of bills and a letter for your mother from Mrs. Churchill,"
Lord Westrum said.
"Your husband is probably having far too good a time to think of writing."
"Don't say that, Pa. He's only doing his duty. He had to go where he was sent."
"And the Bahamas is not exactly a hardship posting."
Lord Westrum looked at his wife, who smiled vaguely.
"How nice for him. I hear they have lovely beaches."
They all looked up as Dido came in. There were goosebumps on her bare shoulders and arms, but her face was glowing from being outside.
"Golly, the whole clan is here. What are you doing up, Mummy? I thought you had told me one of the few luxuries of being a married woman was breakfast in bed."
"Darling, I used to look forward to my fresh brown egg and thin soldiers of lovely fresh bread. Having toast and margarine somehow hardly makes it worthwhile staying in bed."
"I hear you went out looking for the body, Dido," her father said.
He was eyeing her critically.
"Don't tell me you went outside looking like that. You need your head examined. All those bloody soldiers hanging around with too much time on their hands. You'll come a cropper, my girl."
"The soldiers were very sweet to me, Pa. And besides, I was too late to see the body,"
Dido said, helping herself to the last of the kedgeree.
"Oh, goody. Hooray for Mrs. Stubbins. She found kippers for us again."
"Never did I think there would come a day when we would all rejoice over kippers,"
Lord Westrum said.
"I suppose a mere taste is better than nothing, but I really miss my pair of kippers all to myself."
He turned to wave a warning finger at his daughter.
"But in future, Diana, I do not want you wandering all over the property alone, especially not dressed like that. It looks as if you're wearing your pajamas."
"It's the height of fashion, Pa, or at least it was when there was still vogue. Not that there is any point in trying to be fashionable when one is stuck in the depth of the countryside."
She put her plate down next to Phoebe's, then reached over to pat the setter's head before she picked up her napkin.
"If you'd let me get a job up in London, I'd be safely out of your hair, Pa. And I wouldn't have any time on my hands, would I?"
she replied bitterly.
"I'm dying of boredom, you know. There's a war on. Plenty of excitement. I want to be part of it."
"We've been through this before, Dido," Lord Westrum said. "You are too young to go and work on your own in London. I don't mind you helping out with the animals on the home farm, or even helping teach the children at the village school, but that's it, and that's my final word on the subject. Don't bring it up again."
Dido sighed and took her place at the far end of the table. They all looked up at the sound of a heavy, measured tread, and Soames came in, bearing a silver salver.
"A letter for you, my lady," he said. "Hand delivered."
Lady Esme looked surprised as she took it.
"Goodness, what an eventful morning! Who can be writing to me now?"
The rest of the family waited as she took the envelope, noted the crest on the back, and smiled.
"Oh, it's Lady Prescott. I wonder what she wants. I thought we were too impossibly dowdy and old-fashioned for them."
"Perhaps she wants to borrow a cup of sugar," Lord Westrum replied with a snort. "Times are hard for all at the moment, even the Prescotts."
"Oh, not the Prescotts, I think," Livy said. "Every time I take Charlie out in his pram, I seem to see a delivery van pulling up at their house."
"What does it say, Ma?" Dido asked.
Lady Esme looked up, a pleased smile on her face, and began to read aloud.
"Dear Lady Westerham, I wanted to share our good news with you before you heard it through the village grapevine. Our son Jeremy has arrived home safely against all odds. He is naturally weak, recovering from an infected gunshot wound, but we have every reason to hope he will make a full recovery. When he has regained his strength, we look forward to giving a little dinner party in his honour, and hope that your family will be able to join us. Yours sincerely, Madeline Prescott." She folded the letter and looked around at her family, beaming.
"Isn't that wonderful? I must write to Pamela straight away. She'll be thrilled."
"Why Pamma any more than the rest of us?" Dido demanded. "Or is she the favoured child?"
"Dido, you know how sweet Pamma is on Jeremy. In fact, if there hadn't been this stupid war, I rather think there might have been an announcement by now." She gave an enigmatic smile.
"Ma, you're too keen to get your children married off, aren't you? Jeremy Prescott never struck me as the faithful type."
"I'm sure lots of young men sow their wild oats but settle down when the time comes," Lady Esme said. "Anyway, the main thing is that he's home now, and all will be well." She got up. "I must write to Pamma this very minute."
Dido watched her go.
"I don't know where I'm ever supposed to find a husband," she said. "Stuck here in the country, it will have to be a pig farmer, I suppose."
This made Phoebe giggle.
"He'd smell horrible," she said. "But you'd get good bacon."
"That was supposed to be sarcasm, Thebes," Dido said. "I was just reminding everyone that I didn't get my season like my sisters."
"I didn't order this blasted war," Lord Westrum said. "And you're still young. There will be plenty of chance for parties and dances when it's over."
"If you know how to do German folk dances," Phoebe said.
Lord Westrum's face turned beetroot red.
"Not funny, Phoebe. Not in the least bit funny. The Germans will not win, and that's final."
He flung down his napkin and strode from the room. Later that morning, the colonel's adjutant, Captain Hartley, sought out his commanding officer.
"We've checked the tags, sir, and they don't match anyone in the West Kents. Furthermore, all were present and correct at roll call this morning, apart from Jones, who was given 2 days leave because his wife had a baby, and Patterson, who is in the hospital with appendicitis."
"So what do you think we should do now?"
Colonel Pritchard scratched his head, pushing his cap askew.
"Find out who this joker was and why he was wearing our uniform."
"One can't rule out the possibility, sir, that he was a spy. Wearing the uniform of the West Kents would give him a good excuse to roam around this area, wouldn't it?"
Colonel Pritchard sucked air in through his teeth.
"One hears about such things, but surely they are all rumour. Oh, I'm pretty sure there are plenty of fifth columnists around."
"You think so?"
Colonel Pritchard glared.
"Englishmen deliberately wanting to work for the Hun."
"I'm afraid so, sir. If someone needed to contact them, what better way than to parachute a man in on a dark, moonless night?"
Colonel Pritchard stared past him, out across the lawns. He found it hard to believe that this was England, Blake's green and pleasant land, and yet they were no longer safe at home. Bombs were falling indiscriminately, and now maybe spies were working among them.
"Send the tags to Army Intelligence. They can come and take the body. It's out of our hands," he said,
then looked up as a private approached them, walking fast. He stopped, came to attention, and saluted.
"Begging your pardon, Colonel, sir," he said, "but I was one of the men sent to get that body today, and at the time I thought there was something that wasn't quite right.
Then I realized what it was. He still had his cap tucked into his lapel, and the badge was wrong.
Part 2. Ben. Chapter 6. Wormwood Scrubs Prison, Acton, West London, May 1941. The gate to Wormwood Scrubs Prison closed behind Ben Cresswell with a clang of finality. Even though he had been coming and going through this particular gate for the past 3 months, he still felt an odd frisson of fear when he entered, and an absurd sense of relief when he was safely outside again, as if he'd got away undetected.
"Let you out early for good behaviour, then, did they?" the policeman on duty asked him with a grin. The joke had now become old, but apparently the Bobbies still hadn't tired of it.
"Me?
Absolutely not. I escaped over the wall.
Didn't you notice?" Ben replied, straight-faced.
"Shirking on the job." "Get out of here." The policeman chuckled and gave Ben a nudge.
MI5's move to Wormwood Scrubs for security reasons was supposed to be strictly hush-hush. But everyone connected to the prison seemed to be fully aware of what the newcomers who had taken over one wing were up to. Even a bus conductor had been known to announce the stop by yelling down the bus, "All change for MI5! So much for secrecy, Ben thought, while he crossed the street to the bus stop. As the headquarters of a secret service division, the prison had proved to be a dismal failure. The cells they had been assigned were cold and damp. Some doors had actually been removed, so it was easy to overhear what was going on in the next room. Furthermore, it was more inconvenient and difficult to get to than the former headquarters on Cromwell Road. Recently, part of B Division, responsible for counter-espionage, had been moved out to Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire, where rumour had it that, in spite of being in a stately home, the accommodations were even more primitive than at a prison. Even so, Ben wished he'd been assigned there and was actually doing something useful for the war effort. Since he had been recruited into MI5 a year ago, his spy-catching had been confined to following up on rumours and tips in the Greater London area. The rumours were nearly always a waste of time. Mostly, they were false alarms or a chance to even old scores. A nosy old woman had peeked out of her blackout curtain and seen a furtive man slinking past her back garden. Definitely looked like an invading Nazi. Only it turned out to be the lover of the lady next door, sneaking in while her husband was away. Or a woman suspected that her neighbours were secret German sympathisers because they always played Mozart on their radiogram. When Ben pointed out that Mozart was actually Austrian, the woman had sniffed in annoyance. "No difference, really," she'd said. "Wasn't Hitler Austrian? And besides, they were always cooking with garlic. You could smell it a mile off. And if that wasn't suspicious, what was?" Ben turned to look back at the ornate red and white brick towers that housed the prison gate. Trust the Victorians to make even a prison look impressive. Then he walked down Duquesne Road to the East Acton tube station. He hoped the tube would be quicker into central London than a bus, but one never knew. One bomb on the line overnight, and everything would grind to a halt. His gait was slightly uneven and jerky, thanks to the tin knee in his left leg, but he was still able to move quite fast, just not able to play rugger nor bowl at cricket. He was about to cross to the tube station when a man came out of the tobacconist's with a paper under his arm, stared at Ben, then frowned.
"Here you, son! Why aren't you in uniform?" he demanded, waving an aggressive finger at Ben. "What are you, a bleeding conchy?"
Ben had faced similar accusations many times since the war began.
"Aeroplane crash," he said. "One leg smashed up and no use to anyone."
The man's face turned red.
"Sorry, mate.
I didn't realize you were RAF. Shouldn't have spoken like that to one of our brave boys.